Okay. Well, as many of you know from talking to me over the last week, I study an ocular motor system called smooth pursuit eye movements. You can't?
Louder?
Yeah. Oh, I thought it was already being amplified.
No, it's not. It's just for the web.
Oh, I see. Okay. So I study smooth pursuit eye movements, and pursuit is a behavior that humans share with other primates, and it's simply the ability to track a moving target continuously or smoothly with our eyes. It's a primate behavior because primates have fovias. They have regions of their retina with a higher spatial acuity, and
but
so
do that, don't they?
Other animals move their eyes. Yeah, and actually other mammals do have regions of higher receptor density. But pursuit is actually considered a primate, primarily a primate behavior. So today I'm going to talk about work that I'm doing at UCSF in collaboration with Steve Lisberger and Bill Bialik, the goal of which is to try to account for the noise process that limits the precision of the eye movement. So noise can enter the performance of pursuit behavior from the sensory end in how well the brain can estimate the target trajectory from signals on the retina, or it can enter on the motor end and how well we can program and execute the eye movement. Now, there are certainly well-known examples in which neural systems can operate at a fundamental limit set by physical noise sources at the sensory receptors. I mean, examples would be in a dark room, our ability to perceive brief flashes of light is at the level of counting single photons on our retina. And the mechanical sensitivity of our inner ear is set to the level of thermal fluctuations in the cochlea. Now, arguably, from the motor end, limits to motor performance in this sense are less well studied, but there's some evidence that behavioral strategies can be chosen to minimize the impact of noise at the motor output. And here I'm thinking about some recent work that showed that the trajectory of targeted movements, like reaching to targets or saccadic eye movements, are chosen to minimize endpoint variance. Now, identifying the noise source that limits a behavior with a continuous motor output, like pursuit, presents a challenge because describing a time-varying behavior seems to require a large number of parameters. It's a very high-dimensional problem. But there is sort of a growing list of examples in motor systems analysis where even very complex, potentially complex movements, like locomotive movements, limb movements, and grasping postures, for example, are in fact described by just a small number of independent parameters. So with these ideas in mind, I'm going to talk to you about noise in the pursuit system, but I thought I'd start, because I don't expect you all to know a lot about pursuit, by giving you some background. In the Lisberger lab, our favorite experimental subjects for studying pursuit are rhesus macaque monkeys. This is an old world primate. We sit them to do the experiments in a specially designed primate chair to which we can fix their heads. And we do that because we want the movements that we measure to reflect eye movements in the head and not head movements in space. I promise you it's not.
This is a physics audience.
So the animals sit there and they watch visual stimuli moving on a screen. And we monitor their eye movements. And if they successfully track the target moving on the screen, they get a little juice reward. And these animals...
Don't you introduce bias by not allowing them to move their head? Because
do we introduce bias?
Yes. Because usually the way they behave, they probably move their head and their eyes.
Right. You would move them together.
You make gaze
movements. It's true. But we're presenting stimuli in a fairly restricted range of the visual field. You don't tend to move your head until you have to, basically, right? Because it takes more energy to move your head. So I don't think that we're introducing any bias.
Excuse me, are you also making recordings in some other fashion, not just from the eyes?
In the lab, often people would be recording from part of the brain that would be involved in mediating the pursuit behavior. But in this case, I'm just going to talk to you about the behavior itself. And so I'm not going to present any neural data.
Otherwise, you could be using humans.
Otherwise, we could be using humans. Although humans actually aren't as good at this. We can be with a lot of training, but we don't work as hard. Well, experimental investigators can be very motivated to collect data, but still, there's more of a fatigue factor in humans. Okay, let's see if this works. So I have here a movie graciously donated by a former member of the lab that illustrates the kind of visual stimuli we use in the lab to elicit the pursuit movements. What you're going to see is a white, it's easier to explain if I tell you first rather than just put it on. The target is going to be a white circle, and it's going to be stationary for a few moments. Then it's going to displace eccentrically and move back toward the location where it was stationary. The eye position is going to be a green cross, and you'll see it jittering a little bit. It'll be fixated on the target. Then after a delay, which is greatly exaggerated because this movie's not in real time, it's going to accelerate and track the target. Okay, so the target's the white circle. It's remaining fixed for a moment, and the eyes are fixated over it. Then it's displacing, or stepping, as we call it, moving toward the fixation point. And the step is timed so that the pursuit latency period is over, just as the target's crossing the former fixation point, and so the eyes are accelerating smoothly and tracking the target. And if the animal after a grace period that covers the initiation of the movement, keeps his eye on the target within a certain window, he's going to get that juice reward.
Is this real time?
No, absolutely not. This is much slower. So the, you know, I don't know, I didn't measure it, but the pursuit latency is on the order of a tenth of a second, and I would say that that latency is on the order of several seconds, so it's significantly slower. So the jitter comes from simply motor output noise, and we'll talk about that a little bit later on.
It's not measurement noise.
It's not measurement noise. This is actual jitter in the eye movements that you notice happens while the animal's pursuing as well as while he's trying to keep his eyes still.
It's fixational eye movements? Fixational eye movements?
Yeah.
So that's microsaccades or what noise?
Yeah, so it could be microsaccades. It could be, you know, the eyes also have, you can't really see it here, but the eyes can have a sort of a slow drift in their position. You can, of course, there are limits on how still you can keep your eyes.
It could be the motor noise, or could it be that the animal is just very comfortable trying to follow what it believes to be a motion on the target while the target is not moving?
Well, since the target isn't actually moving, then, you know, it's got to be motor system noise to some extent, right?
Well,
noise is a kind of pejorative term. Maybe saying it's not a bad thing.
No. What I'm saying is that maybe you're looking at it and you have noise in the visual system as well as the noise in the motor system, and then the motor system is just bound to the visual system.
It is, yes, it is possible that this could be, that it could be some sort of noise in the estimation of where the target is, even though it's not moving.
Can you tell how big the noise is depending on where? I mean, obviously you measure that, right?
Yeah, I'm gonna show you what the noise looks like. So this simply diagrams the movements that were generated in that movie. The targets are these dashed lines, and the target is stepping to a constant speed and moving in a straight line, so in a constant direction. The eyes after, so the actual latency, as I said, is only about 100 milliseconds, despite what you saw in that movie. So after about 100 milliseconds, the pursuit system accelerates the eyes until the eye speed matches the target speed, and the eye direction matches the target direction. So the signal that drives pursuit isn't target direction in the world, it's actually image motion on the retina, which is the difference between what the target's doing and what the eye is doing. So this signal is, of course, maximal when the target's begun to move, but during the pursuit latency period before the eyes have begun to move. And it decays as the eyes actually catch up to the target. Now, on longer time scales, the pursuit system uses feedback in order to match the eye trajectory to the target trajectory. But on short time scales of roughly 125 milliseconds after the initiation of pursuit, the behavior is thought to be performed open loop, meaning it's just programmed from the feed forward sensory estimate of what the target was doing.
How well is this known?
How well is this known? It's known, the presence of the feedback signal comes on at about this time. The way I measure it in a lab is by stabilizing an image of the target on the retina. So I basically lock what the target's doing to what the eyes are doing. And then I look at where the eye velocity for a stabilized target, like so at some point in time around here, begins to diverge from an actual pursuit target, where the eye was catching up. So basically, I'm manipulating the situation, forcing it to be open loop, and I see where naturally in the behavior it looked like the feedback loop closed.
Yeah. Does this depend at all, or your results are they depend at all on your choice of the target trajectory? That is, this sort of simple step.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how often that occurs when you're just sitting here and all of a sudden you have to start pursuing.
So the acceleration profile of the target can affect the time course of pursuit. But this isn't actually something that accelerates rapidly. I mean, a step is very rapid, but something that accelerates rapidly or that you begin to see move from rest isn't that uncommon, a natural stimulus. And it happens to be simply a very convenient, simple stimulus to use to probe the behavior. Okay, this is a very simplified cartoon of some of the neural pathways in the primate brain involved in pursuit. Image motion on the retina is projected via the thalamus to primary visual cortex, and then up to area MT, which is a region of cortex that's specialized for detecting motion. Cells in MT are tuned for direction and speed of image motion. MT is the first cortical area that makes a primary descending projection via the pons to areas of the cerebellum and then out to brainstem and eye motor nuclei that are going to send the motor commands to the eye muscles and actually move the eyes. So this loop is about six synapses to go after the retina, you know, to go from retinal signals to eye movements.
And the cerebellum is an essential part of this loop. It can't be bypassed.
Probably. So the cerebellum is involved in aspects of motor learning and timing of the movement, et cetera. So,
but a cerebellar lesion isn't a disaster for this, is it?
That's a good question. So, not being an expert on the cerebellum, I mean, I think it would depend on where it was, and I don't know what kind of deficits you would start to see in the movement. All right. So, I'm going to now start to show you some experimental data that was generated by stimuli that were very similar to what I showed you before. But now I'm going to manipulate the target trajectories. There we go. In particular, what I'm going to do is change the target direction. So the targets are still going to be moving at a constant speed. Oh, I thought this was looping. But still in straight lines. And I'm going to randomly interleave different target directions, 14 different target directions. I'm just showing you just a set. They're actually balanced, a balanced set around the origin. So if I repeat motion of one of those directions many times, I can build up a sample of variability in the pursuit response. So this is just a single trace of the horizontal eye velocity in response to target motion 6 degrees from horizontal. And this is 200 examples where velocity is shown as color density. Here I've aligned all of these responses on the onset of target motion, but I actually randomized the timing of the target motion within a half-second interval to try to eliminate any predictive eye movements. So these 200 trials weren't presented in order. In other words, I didn't just present 6-degree motion over and over again, because that would fatigue the animal. The target motion was randomly interleaved, but I've just plucked out of this long experiment the 200 repetitions to this particular direction.
What's the total duration of the experiment?
Total duration of this experiment was probably on the order of 2.5 hours. So I think what you can see here is that there's some jitter in the initiation of the eye movement, which happens just about here. And there's also some variability in the eye speed after 300 milliseconds after the target starts to move. So the target speed here was 20 degrees per second. And since it's close to horizontal, this is a good estimate of the eye speed. And you can see that sometimes the eyes are moving a little too fast and sometimes a little bit too slow. So there's noise in the pursuit response. But I think you can also see that there's a high degree of regularity and that there's something stereotyped about the time course of pursuit trial by trial. So I'm going to quantify. And you can also probably see that there's a little bit of steady increase in the pursuit latency. Is that what you're talking about?
Fatigue.
Yeah, by fatigue. Mm-hmm. And sometimes this can be quite pronounced, actually. So I'm going to quantify over the next few slides what's stereotyped about pursuit, or what's reproducible about pursuit, by looking at the mean responses over those few hundred trials. So target motion in my experiments is parameterized by direction, speed, and a time of motion onset. Because pursuit's a tracking movement, we expect that the velocity profile of the pursuit response is also going to be parameterized by those, by the target motion parameters. This is what the mean horizontal and vertical eye velocity look like from that data set that I just showed you. The dashed lines here are the different components of the target velocity. So you can see that the animal's matching the vertical component of the target motion pretty well here. And it gets close in the horizontal movement, but not quite. If I plot these in polar form, vertical versus horizontal eye velocity, This red square here would represent the target velocity. You can see that the trajectory that the eyes are taking are actually lining up with the direction quite well. So what's our prediction if the target were moving in a different direction? So our naive prediction is that what would happen is that we would just take this pursuit trajectory and we would rotate it. Similarly, if the target were moving a little faster or a little slower, you might expect that we would just scale up the velocity time courses. And if the target started moving a little later, a little sooner, we would shift them around in time. Oops. So more formally, what I'm saying is that we might predict that there is some sort of stereotyped underlying average pursuit response at some reference direction, reference speed, starting at some times t0, say. And that perhaps we can predict what the average trajectory, if pursuit is perfectly stereotyped, will be at any combination of target motion parameters by an appropriate time-shifting rotation or scaling. So I'm going to test this prediction that's a model of sort of ideal transformation properties if pursuit is ideally stereotyped against experimental data.
Excuse me, what is ideal? I don't quite understand what it
is. I mean ideal only in the sense, not in the sense that somehow the time course of the pursuit movement is optimized against some constraint. I mean it only in the sense that given the basic shape of the time course, what I'm going to call the stereotyped movement, I can predict what pursuit will look like to any combination of these target motion parameters by just rotating it, scaling it, shifting it. So it's an ideal transformation.
So it's really just, it's the existence of stereotype trajectories.
It's the existence of stereoptopy.
It looks as if they underestimate both vertical and horizontal movement.
Yeah, vertical a little bit.
If you scale the velocities, is one really done any better than the other? I mean, it looks like you get, I don't know, whatever it is, 95% of the horizontal asymptote. It looks like it might be similar, at least, in the vertical one.
I'm sorry, so if I scale, meaning if I change speeds, do they do better at matching the speed?
No, if you look at what the asymptotic pursuit velocity was as a fraction of the target velocity, mm-hmm. it looks like it might be rather similar for both horizontal and vertical.
Are they different? Yeah, this might vary a little bit target direction by target direction, but I haven't looked at that systematically to be able to know whether there's any consistent difference between what I would call the vertical gain, like the vertical eye velocity versus the vertical target velocity in the horizontal.
Sorry, one more question. How could this not be true?
This could not be true if there were some sort of handedness to pursuit. If you did something different with your eyes when you move them to the left or to the right, and the whole time course of how you accelerated the eyes would look different. Or if you always drifted a little bit upward, or you always drift a little bit downward.
Even cells that may have muscles which are horizontal, vertical, and now what's being told is that they pursuit not only these two main directions, but in the middle direction as well. It's just a rotation at the top of this big pursuit, which means that the muscles have to be very...
So it's likely true for sufficiently small deviations or something, this is always going to be true.
It's more likely to be true with small deviations.
For small angles around the vertical.
Right.
What's the largest angle you look at?
Let me get there. Do I check? So I've just done these recordings in one eye. So if everything's working well and the animal's making conjugate eye movements, so we have one of our eye movements behaviors that we move our eyes together, it should be coordinated. But I haven't, because I'm only recording from one eye, I can't answer that question.
Can you make sure that the animal doesn't have any problems about the muscles they're controlling?
Yes. So we study them fairly extensively, and we only get to use the animals that can do a good job at this, basically. Okay, so how stereotyped is pursuit? Are the pursuit trajectories to different target directions? So here's a set which I have perhaps shrewdly chosen. You'll note to be clustered around the horizontals. You'll see here the vertical scale is much different from the horizontal scale. These directions are spaced in 3-degree increments around horizontal. These are each the average trajectories over 200 or so repetitions. And this is this yellow one, I believe, is the target motion I just showed you in the previous slide. So what you can see here is a couple things. These squares are representing the target velocity, and you can see that while these trajectories are spaced out, encouraging us to think that there might be a rotation going on here, the endpoints of the trajectories don't always match up. Sometimes they do quite well, but they don't always match up with the target direction. There's also this funny little bobble in the eyes when the animal initiates the movement. So the first thing I'm going to do before quantifying how stereotyped the pursuit is to subtract out the overall mean eye velocity, which is this bias velocity I've shown in this inset figure. The bias is small. The scale here is a few tenths of a degree per second as opposed to degrees per second. And it doesn't point in any particular direction the way it would if there were some handedness to pursuit or some overall drift, say, upwards or downwards, whenever the animal made an eye movement. So with this set of 14 trajectories, I'm going to do a singular value decomposition to try to identify the modes from which I can construct a stereotype pursuit response. And I can then reconstruct all of these different mean trajectories. My trajectories have a horizontal and vertical component in time. I'm keeping 125 milliseconds of pursuit, and I've digitized these at 1 millisecond resolution. So each of these vectors has 250 time points. So what my singular value decomposition will give me are 14 possible modes with which I can represent the mean trajectories in each of these directions. And the coefficients is going to tell me something about the fraction of variance that each of these modes will capture. So I do this analysis, and I find that keeping two modes will account for 98% of the variance of the means, which is quite good. And this is true over 6 experiments in 3 different animals. And what that says is that instead of needing 14 different modes to reconstruct the mean eye velocity in my different target directions, I only need a linear combination of 2. And these modes look like this. The first mode, the solid line here, is almost perfectly horizontal. And the second mode is almost perfectly vertical. Now, this wasn't enforced by the SVD analysis. That requires that each of the net direction of each of the modes be orthogonal, not that they be orthogonal time point by time point. So this has just come out of the pursuit data itself. So the ideal prediction was that the mean pursuit responses should be rotations of some stereotyped response. And so to see whether this is true, I should test the SVD coefficients against the predicted elements of the rotation matrix for each of the target directions. See if they agree.
Which, in the different experiments, which angles, which was the range?
The range?
Of the angles.
The range was -9 to +9 degrees, left and right, in 3-degree increments.
Just -9, why not -45?
Right. So I looked. So the reason for that was to start with small directional changes and to see how consistent pursuit was being generous, right, where you just had to make small changes each time. I've tested this up to eccentricities of about 30 degrees, and it holds. I haven't gone as high as completely oblique angles or yet analyzed vertical pursuit, which might be a little bit different.
So how many total trajectories do you sort of need before you can be comfortable that you have enough data to
How many examples of each one?
Yeah.
Well, so these are the averages over 200 repetitions, which is less important perhaps for studying the means,
right,
as it will be later for the noise. So my tailored sets tend to be big.
So what is, I mean, if you did the similar analysis for not 14 directions but say 10 directions, is there a big difference between the modes and
no?
It seems like the reason you have those SVDs is just because of the way you design the experiment. I mean, there's most variance in the horizontal direction because that's what you've asked them to do, and then there's a little bit, then there's a small amount of variance in the vertical direction. So it's not that surprising that you get those two SVDs, right?
Not so surprising that I get a horizontal and vertical
and a vertical component, because that's how the experiment was designed.
No. The reason why it's surprising, so it's not, I'm not getting just two modes because my animals are pursuing targets that appear on a flat screen, which is a, you know, two-dimensional motion. Because it could have been that you did something differently with your eyes when you pursued in this direction as when you pursued in that direction. In other words, this is saying something about pursuit and not the dimensionality of the problem.
Right, okay, but suppose you'd rotated it by 90 degrees,
mm-hmm.
then the first singular vector would be up or down, and the second one would be left or right. Suppose you rotated it 45 degrees, mm-hmm. then the first one would be in this direction, the second one would be in that direction.
Yes, that's true. You know, that's potentially true. But as I said, what all that is required is of the SVD modes is that the integral over time of the first and second mode,
right,
be zero.
That's all that's required.
So what we found additionally was that our two modes were zero time point by time point.
So you're saying it could be that they take some kind of curved trajectory instead of a straight line, and the curve is kind of the same whether they're going left or right, something like that. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying that what I'm finding is that pursuit is stereotyped enough, at least over these range of directions, so that it only takes two modes to be able to predict what the pursuit was left or right within 9 degrees of horizontal.
Physiologically, are there two sets of muscles, horizontal one, seven, pair, and a pair?
There's a horizontal pair, vertical pair, and an oblique pair.
Could you just go back to the last picture? Before that, the one before that. And before that. That one.
This one.
So the point is that if I understand, maybe I don't understand, the left or right movement is the main singular mode. And then the second mode is the up or down.
It's not just left or right, it's a whole velocity and time trace.
Right.
Right.
And trace up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And the interesting point is that this velocity time trace is the same irrespective of whether you're going in zero direction or in, you know, 3 degrees, whatever, 2 degrees, etc.
So it's because they're straight lines.
Not just kind of the whole thing.
No, it's not, they're not just straight lines. Remember, they look in time, right? Like that.
Okay.
I hide the time course a little bit by showing them in this polar format, but it's easier to see the direction since that's what I'm varying.
The point is that the acceleration profile is the same.
That's right, yes.
Sorry, you're telling me so.
That's okay.
But, I mean, you always say, you know, that it could have been that the left and the right would be different, but, I mean, we know there is a symmetry between left and right, so why is that? Why would I expect?
Well, you have handedness in your reaching movements.
What does that mean?
Handedness meaning that you do things a little bit differently when you reach with your left hand versus when you reach with your right hand, because one hand's dominant over the other.
Well, that's hands, but, you know, with eyes.
But it's not just the left versus right
here. You don't have leggedness? I wonder.
When you're looking slightly up, you'll also look, you'll have a different acceleration profile in the horizontal direction. Do you know what I mean? It could be that when you want to only go right, you go there faster, than when you want to go right and up, you go slower. Do you see what I mean? And that's not.
Yeah,
what's
well, that's
happening.
That's not what. Yeah. What about rotation? I mean, doesn't the eye also? Can the eye also just
makes run? Very small torsional movements? Yeah.
So listings.
Yeah.
So what about that?
What about it?
There's something listing law that says that it doesn't rotate, even though it could. It doesn't.
I see.
Well, you mean just in humans, right? Because in fish, there's a lot of torsional motion.
Yeah, they
don't generalize the results to fish.
Okay. Oh, you're not recording.
No.
You're recording from fish.
Oh.
No, you're not recording.
No, I'm not recording torsional motion. Okay, so I'm going to make the comparison now between the SVD coefficients of these two modes, these two dominant modes that I measure, and the sines and cosines of a rotation matrix. And when we do that, we plot them against each other, for each of the 14 different coefficients for the first mode, which is primarily horizontal and should look like a cosine of theta, and these are the 14 modes, some of the circles are on top of each other, of the coefficients of the second mode, which are like the sine of the angle. And you can see that they indeed lie on a slope of unity. And the deviations here from perfect behavior are the degree to which those the pursuit trajectories didn't quite match up with the target directions. So what that means is that I should be able to reconstruct the time course of the average pursuit responses to each of my different directions using just two modes scaled by cosines and sines, which I'm showing you here. This is the time course for plus 6 degrees and minus 6 degrees of motion, I believe. And this is the vertical component. The black lines are actually means and standard deviations of the data. And the red lines are my reconstruction from my two SVD modes. And you can see that we get pretty close most of the time. Here I've added back in that bias velocity trajectory I took out, and so I'm also able to reconstruct these little bubbles as the animal starts to initiate.
What do we know about these bubbles? Why do they happen?
Why do they happen? I don't know why they happen, but it isn't surprising that when you are releasing yourself from being still, in this case with your eyes fixated, that you might have some sort of preparatory stereotyped motion that you make, a setup, if you will,
so
to start.
So is there an actual muscular contraction to hold the eyes fixed that's then released?
Well, you probably have a balance, you know, a balanced contraction between both of your muscles.
Okay. And the point is, this bubble, is that being released?
That's my guess.
Probably there's some contraction because it's very hard to fix it.
You have to work. Fixation is an active process.
Mm-hmm. Very quickly. Yeah. I mean, it's painful.
In heaven, the bump does not contradict the orthogonality.
I subtract the bump off when I did the analysis. So the bump was small. This is the bump. Bump was pretty small. It didn't point in any particular direction. So I don't think it's going to affect the structure of the modes. But I could try, I could leave it in and see what, how much of the variance I could capture. Okay. So in this sense, you know, what I hope I've motivated for you is that that at least in the transformation properties of the average pursuit responses, that they're behaving according to this ideal picture of how they should transform with target motion parameters. So the SVD analysis gave me the stereotyped pursuit response from the two modes, and that we can rotate that scale. I didn't show you scaling, but I showed you that at least we could rotate that. And sort of implicitly, because the time of motion onset in my experiment was randomized over such a big window, so 500 milliseconds, I'm showing you that we can also shift these in time and still predict the structure of the average response to a different time. Now, trial by trial, we expect that our individual observations of pursuit eye velocity will look like this ideal picture with that bias term back in, and there should be noise there. So part of that noise might look like noise at the motor output, like a background jitter in the eye movements that was present all the time while the animals were fixated, while they were pursuing. You saw that a little bit in that first movie, that the eyes were jittering around. And we should see a term that looks like fluctuations around this ideal trajectory. Now, fluctuations around the ideal trajectory could come from misestimations of the target motion parameters, so misestimating the direction, the speed, and the timing. If these errors are small, we should be able to write them like this. There should be your error in sensing direction. I'm sorry, so the error in estimating direction should point along some directional mode, and similarly for speed and timing. So I'm going to argue that the form of these modes we can predict from the transformation properties of the stereotype response. In other words, if you make small errors in estimating direction and speed and timing, what that should look like in terms of how your whole eye movement trajectory will fluctuate is like what would happen if there were real changes in target motion. In other words, what would happen up here. So this is saying that I can use the transformation properties of the mean to predict what these natural error modes would look like just by taking the appropriate derivatives of the stereotype response that I already predicted. So this is kind of the key, so I just wanted to take a moment, the key point to this analysis. That what we're saying is that on these short timescales where there's no feedback available to pursuit, that pursuit is operating a little bit like a lookup table, in the sense that you perceive a target moving in the world at some direction. So you dial in a pursuit response and rotate to that direction. But if you get it wrong, either you get it wrong because you've missensed which direction the target was going in, or you've planned your action a little bit incorrectly, you'll be off by some small angle, delta theta. And that should look like small rotations around what the predicted average response should be. Similarly for scaling and timing. Now, it doesn't have to be.
If your target is predictable, repeated to the animal, is behavior changing?
You can get predictive pursuit movements.
So, for example, if it was a symmetry.
If it was.
Then.
You learn to slow your eyes down.
Hold off a short while.
Yes. So this would be. So this statement is going to be most true when there's minimal of predictive movements and you're performing this movement without feedback so that there's no chance to correct an error that you sense along the way. And so it's just driven by some initial estimate of what the target trajectory would be.
Essentially it is ballistic,
yes. Well, ballistic means, no, ballistic means that it's just, yeah. Yeah, it's just feed forward.
What about the animal learns? So you have trained the animal for several months, you know how to do that remaining.
Right, so do you remember all those, there were a lot of parts of that in that cartoon of the nervous system involved in pursuit that I didn't talk about? Everything here and forward? There was a reason why I didn't talk about it. So that's a whole other layer that pursuit system can learn, and so you can actually disrupt this picture by being just purely feed-forward sensory-driven by learning, and you can change the shape of your pursuit response.
How do you remove feedback? So you just show the dot in the very beginning of the movement, and then it has to just...
No, I'm just looking at the very beginning of the movement when I know that the feedback hasn't had time to be incorporated into the movement. First 125. So before I leave this slide, I just want to say that, of course, if these errors that drive these fluctuations in the pursuit vector, if they're sensory, that's the sensory noise is setting a lower noise floor on the performance of pursuit. We're not saying that there can't be other noise sources present, but sensory errors should certainly limit this, should be a lower bound on the fluctuations that we observe. So to characterize the pursuit noise, I'm going to look at the fluctuations, the velocity vector fluctuations around the direction-specific means. If I form the covariance matrix, this would just depend on these two terms. I and J here are just indexing my horizontal versus vertical components. If the background has an appropriate structure that I can actually subtract it off, can form a difference covariance matrix that actually isolates just these fluctuations in the ideal trajectory. And our argument is that while the actual pursuit vectors are going to have a dimension 250, so that this is a 250 by 250 matrix, that this that the structure of delta V ideal is going to predict that 250-250 matrix actually lives in just three dimensions.
Can you just explain what all of these different delta V's.
Okay. So delta V ideal are fluctuations around this predicted response,
right,
where it's predicted from this equation. Okay. And delta V ideal is given by this equation here. I'm postulating this. This is a model of what those fluctuations would look like.
Okay.
So they have a directional component that has a directional error along a particular mode. And that mode I'm going to get by differentiating the stereotype pursuit response with the
background and bias.
So the fluctuations here, I'm saying, are going to be, I'm looking at fluctuations around the direction specific and bias corrected mean. So in other words, I'm subtracting this off.
The bias is the bubble.
Bias is the bubble.
And background is?
Background is that motor jitter. Okay, so it is here. I'm just saying that,
so
I'm going to show you what it looks
zero.
Like.
That's the point about background. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So if it's an additive background, I can subtract it off. And if it has nice properties, it's small and it's time translation invariance and all that stuff.
So you just subtract something from the covariance, a constant from the covariance equation.
Yes, and I'll show you what it, I'll show you what the background looks like in just a moment.
So this dimensional reduction is—it's really just a rephrasing of the fact that you're using this particular feed-forward model, parameterized by.
Yes, this is just a restatement. It's restatement of this equation, basically. Right, so I'm just saying, if this is so.
Which is really a restatement of the first
Which one. Is really a restatement of this one. If this is so, it should carry through into the actual structure of noise that I see in pursuit.
That is, the noise comes from this misestimation of the parameters.
Exactly, exactly. And now I'm going to test this prediction against the data. So here is the horizontal-horizontal component of the covariance of the actual pursuit trajectories, where I've subtracted off the average, the mean trajectory in each of the directions. But this data comes from the whole experiment in all 14 directions. So it's covering a longer time. So the target is beginning to move at time zero, which is about here. And there's a latency, and then this green box denotes the open loop period of pursuit that I'm going to analyze, and this yellow box denotes this background noise jitter. And you can see on this scale that the background is quite small and has no structure here, so it looks time translation invariant.
It looks
small, and I just put it on the same scale to show you that it was small. I'll show it to you.
So subtracting
it doesn't make a huge difference. And this is what, so there's some process with a short correlation time in the background, less than 10 milliseconds. And there's another process that has a longer correlation time that approximates drift in the eye position. But the background is very close to being Gaussian here. So I am going to subtract that off. And I don't change the structure. So here I've just taken the yellow box and subtracted it from the green box. And I don't really change the structure of the covariance during pursuit. Again, so this matrix should, the total covariance should have a 250 dimensions. And our prediction from this ideal behavior model of pursuit is that most of this variation should live in just three modes. So I do an eigenvalue decomposition of the covariance matrix, and I find indeed that a small number of modes, only a small number, are significant. And this low-dimensional structure that I see, where it's about three, and we can argue about the fourth one, is highly statistically significant, even when I test it against alternative noise models. So we did things like, what if we model pursuit noises looking exactly like the background, but with a variance that grows, as you can see here, with the eye velocity. Then we find out that we get lots more than three modes. We got on the order of 60 or 70 modes. We also took the modeled the noise as looking like the background jitter with the actual correlation structure, but then again with the variance scaled with the eye speed. And still found that we couldn't achieve this low-dimensional structure.
Which is the first mode? Which is the first mode? Second and third?
Which is it?
To which one delta is it crisp? The mode is crisp.
I'll get there.
This is just the eigenvectors, eigenvalues of the covariance matrix.
That's right.
All.
That's all it is. I haven't assumed any model. This is just.
Let's say if you plot the eigenvalues as log eigenvalue magnitude, then you should see a gap probably if it's really true.
There isn't. I'll show you. I'm going to show you the numbers in just a moment, so you can gauge for yourself, you know, how big they are. So if I plot the cumulative fraction of variance that each of these modes contributes to, this is mean and standard deviations across five experiments. I find that three modes capture about 94% of the variation in pursuit mode. Okay. So now I have these orthogonal modes from my eigenvalue decomposition of the covariance matrix. What I want to find out is how the natural error modes from the sensory estimates overlap with these modes. In other words, I've predicted something close to the right number of modes for us to be seeing this ideal structure of the noise, sensory-driven noise in pursuit. But do they have the right form? that I predicted from the stereotype pursuit response. So here I've computed the overlap between each of the modes, the direction, speed, and timing, with all 250, although I'm only showing you 8 here, of the eigenmodes of the covariance matrix. And you can see visually that they overlap very well. The direction mode, which is this black circle, has a very high degree of overlap with the third eigenmode. And speed and timing seem to be evenly split, but with opposite signs of projection onto the first two modes. So this is showing you the same, this is the data from one experiment, but with numbers, because it can be a little bit easy to see. So the total from looking at 3 eigenmodes captures about 94% of the variance. The fractional overlap with direction summed over the first 3 modes is about 95%. And for speed and time is over 99%. So there's a very high degree of overlap between the first 3 modes of the covariance matrix and these natural modes that I defined just from the transformation properties of the average pursuit responses. So the structure of the modes really does...
It looked like that, can you go back again? That speed and time are both mode 1 and mode 2 is nowhere to be seen.
So mode 2, here, let's go back to the picture. So you have good eyes. So it looks like there's not very much happening with mode 2.
Right.
So it both gets a projection of about the same size but opposite sign from the first mode. But it's essential here, you know, we need 3 modes because we need to disambiguate errors in speed and errors in timing, meaning...
What do the modes actually look like? Yeah. Can you just plot them?
What do these modes actually look like?
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Can you draw them on the board?
Yeah, you know? Rather than me trying to guess, you know, and trying to remember what they look like, I would say that we can just do, why don't we do that after the talk?
Can I ask you a very simple question? What's the goal?
What I'm trying to get at, what I'm trying to motivate is that sensory errors or errors living in a sensory coordinate frame actually account for the structure of pursuit noise that I see. So I've just shown you that I've got the right number of dimensions, and now I've actually shown you that they have the right form to have the errors that I. So they actually look like these predicted error modes that I derived.
Oh wait, sorry, can I ask them? You haven't really, those aren't necessarily sensory errors. They're errors in the parameters of that model. Now where those come from?
Absolutely, absolutely. It's just easiest to talk about at this point, I found, as being sensory errors, but you're absolutely right. I haven't shown you that they're sensory errors. That's gonna take another step. But I'm gonna get there in just a moment. So this big covariance matrix that's 250 by 250 actually lives in this smaller three-dimensional space. And from it, we can determine what the RMS noise levels along each of our direction, speed, and timing modes are, and the correlation coefficients between the errors, which I'm showing you here. These are 6 different experiments. This is the fraction of the variance captured by the 3 natural modes. And the RMS noise levels in direction, in speed, and timing. The directional noise levels were about 3 degrees. The example data set I've been showing you throughout the talk is here. It's actually one of the noisier ones. So the noise level in direction here and speed were much higher than normal. But the best performance is about 2.7 degrees in direction, about 14% in speed, and in timing, 6.6 milliseconds. Now, between these errors between these modes, correlated errors between the modes, were only significant for speed and timing fluctuations. And they have a sign to look like a corrective strategy. If you start too late, move faster to catch up. But because there's no, you're not getting any feedback on the time scale that I'm analyzing the movement over, then it's less likely to be sort of a corrective evidence of a correction that you're making. And it seems to be more likely to indicate some correlation between your estimates of speed, the speed at which something's moving, and the time at which it started moving. But that's just a prediction. What we found is that the errors along directions were completely not correlated with any modes, and we actually calculated the mutual information between noise fluctuations along direction and each of the other modes, and it was always within error bars of being zero. So this is interesting. You might think that we would get that just by some sort of rotational invariance constraint. Although the fact that there's a bias velocity and there is some overall like thing that happens every time, it does look like rotation symmetry isn't exactly preserved. But the same neural population in MT is mediating the sensation of direction and of speed. So it's kind of interesting to me, actually, that errors in direction and speed are completely uncorrelated. The distribution of noise along each of the error modes is very close to being Gaussian. I'm not going to show you that. And
when you showed the original video, it looked like the points jumping around in little saccades, right? Little flicks, which is very not Gaussian. But if you then take the a dot product of that with this mode, you'll be adding a lot of non-Gaussian variables together. And you'll get, by a central limit theorem, you'll get something that looks very Gaussian. See what I'm saying? It doesn't mean it just because the sum of a whole lot of variables is Gaussian, it doesn't mean the variables work.
Okay. All right, now, to get back to your point, you know, how do I know that this is sensory noise? Or in what way can I evaluate whether the noise contribution that I'm seeing is just living in the space of sensory variables of target direction, speed, and time of motion onset? Or is it actually due to noise in your brain's estimate of what the target trajectory was? The way I can think of doing that is by comparing the noise levels I get along direction, speed, and timing with perceptual thresholds for gauging differences between directions and different speeds and different times. So we know that the pathways for perception all go through MT as well. And so we're using the same neural population to both perform the behavior and to estimate differences in the visual motion. But in the literature, I can only get numbers for humans. And of course, these are coming from monkeys, so there's a little bit of a difference. But interestingly enough, the difference isn't huge. And so in direction, my monkeys, the best performance was 2.7 degrees of directional noise, and the average was 2.9 degrees. Humans.
A monkey would have these numbers better than for a human, right? It's a faster animal in terms of.
No, all right, these are human discrimination thresholds. Okay, so I'm comparing a different thing. So what I should ideally be comparing discrimination of small differences
of
target direction in this case. Okay. And speed differences. And I don't have a number for timing. So ideally, what I should do is design a perceptual discrimination task for the monkeys to perform, right? So that in the same animal, I'm asking it, well, how well can you tell the difference between when the target's moving like this?
So when you say discrimination, like it means, did you see a difference? Not
did you
did
see
they
a
actually
difference? That's right. So this is how large was the noise in their response, in their tracking responses along these different dimensions. And this is how big of a difference can you as a human actually see? Okay. So the answer is that the monkey's behavior is a little bit worse, but not a lot worse than human perceptual thresholds. Now, If we wait a longer time, if I look at 200 milliseconds of the pursuit movement instead of 125 milliseconds, then that feedback loop is started to close. And the animal's able to make a little bit of a corrective movement. Then I find that the noise along the directional mode is extremely close to perceptual thresholds, as if what feedback is doing is eliminating that bit of extra noise that's coming from the motor system, so that you're actually then, you're getting close to optimizing your performance to the level of perceptual noise.
Any idea what kind of errors there are on the discrimination threshold? You say, you know, delta beta is about, but what's the...
It's very hard to get these numbers out of the literature. If I had access to, it'd be nice to get numbers from the labs that actually did this, so then I could get real ranges and error bars and things like that, but I don't have them. So this is just meant to be compelling us, how do we think, yes, provocative rather than definitive in any way. So I would say, just in words, that it looks like that much but not all of the noise that I'm observing in pursuit is accounted for by noise and sensory estimates. That certainly, you know, a good third of it is motor noise, but it's a very particular kind of motor noise because it's living in the same space of sensory noise. In other words, it's also living along these direction, speed, and timing modes of fluctuations. So that's about it, except for some conclusions. So we captured 94% of the behavioral variance in three dimensions, and the form of these dimensions has a high degree of overlap with these natural error modes, and that pursuit noise levels are at least near human perceptual thresholds, suggesting that action and perception are sharing a common limiting noise source in this oculomotor system.
Okay, so it seems like what you've shown is that there's some regularities in the system. In theory, the eyes can take any wiggly trajectory they like to get anywhere, mm-hmm. but in fact, they follow a very stereotype trajectory. It could be even stronger if you can actually say, and this is what those regularities are. Like, you give some differential equation. You might imagine that you've got your target velocity and your actual velocity, and the target velocity approaches it with some sort of linear differential equation or something like that. If you can actually write down some explicit model from the data.
So if I could write down an explicit model in that sense, then yeah. I could probably also ask whether, given the constraints of, you know, what I think that the pursuit is trying to achieve, like minimizing the time to put your eye on the target or minimizing the effort used to move
exactly,
your eyes
like
there,
in kinematics
whether something is
jerk models and
right.
what have you.
That's true. Yeah.
Has anyone tried anything like this for eye movements? I know it's been done for bodily movements.
For saccadic eye movements people have, but not yet for pursuit.
Okay. Right. And then you could even try and get in the fact that the noise follows the same path. You could say, where in this equation can I put a noise source that then means that my noise obeys the same rules?
That's a very reasonable line of investigation.
So in your data set, mostly trajectories are horizontal. Do you have
in this data set, yes.
Including vertical and is that
I haven't looked at the vertical data sets yet, okay. So I've this basic picture holds. for pursuit up to about 30 degrees in oblique.
Yeah,
that's what I've tried. I'm not saying it doesn't hold after that. I just haven't gathered the data to look at more oblique directions yet.
Have you thought about actually blurring the target? So adding in sensory errors that you can control in some way and seeing then how those propagate through.
So I did a different set of manipulations than that, but that's a very good idea of trying to manipulate the sensory signal in a way that doesn't totally disrupt the motor signal. Some of the problems that I ran into, like I tried to make the spot very, very dim and low contrast, but I couldn't make it so dim that we couldn't see it. In other words, I couldn't get near our threshold of being able to detect the dot. So I knew I was really degrading the sensory stimulus before the animal would simply stop pursuing it. So he could fixate it perfectly well, but the threshold to initiate pursuit is high enough so that he just wouldn't bother to when it moved. He'd be like, oh, okay, it's moving. And he wouldn't.
Sorry. How big was the spot? 9 gyroceptrons?
The spot was, you know, it varied in size, but a few tenths of a degree, let's see.
So
not small enough.
You're going to anticipate, I think, the question.
If you were going to ask me, you know, could we figure out in terms of, you know, how well could the animal absolutely do predicted from cone spacing on the retina or something like that, like trying to degrade.
To rephrase it, if you made the spot very large, where in the spot would the animal look? There would be some uncertainty about trying to make a judgment about the center of the spot. So my question really is, to what extent is this behavior confounded with the geometry of the display?
It isn't. It also works for patches of dots. In other words, where I give a whole field of very tiny dots. You know, presumably once the animals get used to seeing such things, they pursue them very well. And there really isn't a particular target that they can choose.
Okay, while I'm pursuing, just remind me, the stimulus just appeared, moved with constant velocity, disappeared, and it will move again in some other direction. Did you ever vary its velocity along the trajectory?
Make it accelerate, for example?
Well, yes, at least.
I haven't tried that yet. And it's a good idea to see if then it takes more modes, basically, to describe
all of it. What I'm fishing towards is how long along the trajectory does the animal begin to believe it knows what's happening and is able to anticipate the remainder of the course? So if this animal can present it repeatedly with a single spot moving linearly in a variety of directions.
Right.
So it says, okay, here it comes again, I know what to do, I just start heading off in this direction. So I know what's going to happen next when it goes so far, let's stop and start over in some other direction.
Oh, does he begin to anticipate the end of the movement?
Yes, from almost the very beginning. So in other words, can you go through your data sequentially and see whether any of the analysis depends upon where in the study you're recording the data?
Oh, well, it does absolutely depend. I'm only taking the very initial part of the movement, because later on, where I'm, like after 125 milliseconds, I know that the eye movements are complicated by feedback and he can make corrective strategies. He can find that he's beginning to poop out, for example, not track the target quite as well, then realize he won't get his reward unless he brings his eyes back up and he'll make a corrective movement. So.
But even this very little bit at the beginning, it still knows what it's going to get. The only uncertainty the animal has is the onset and the orientation. Is that correct?
Yes, it knows that it's going to get a target, that it's going to move in a straight line, I would say. It certainly knows that. But it doesn't know where on the screen it's going to appear. And it doesn't know, what direction. Sometimes what speed. It knows it's going to be constant velocity, but it won't necessarily know what that velocity is.